climate change requires attention, and if you're going to be spending hundreds of billions of dollars as part of an economic recovery, then the least you can do is make sure that that aligns with your climate obligations. You can stimulate the economy from the pandemic, but you can also drive climate action. You invest in clean energy, you invest in manufacturing based on clean energy, you invest in hydrogen energy, but using renewable energy rather than using gas and coal.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and at the time of recording this, on Tuesday the 19th of May, The Guardian is reporting that Australia has 704 active cases of COVID-19, 6,258 recovered cases, and a sad 99 deaths.
Remember the climate wars? Yep, seems like a lifetime ago. But since COVID-19 knocked climate change off the front pages, something remarkable's happened. Nature's taken a deep breath.
The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed the fragility of all societies and economies to global shocks, such as disease or climate disruption. As we recover, we must build back better for people and the planet.
We need to tackle both the corona pandemic, this crisis, at the same time as we tackle the climate and environmental emergency.
Once the COVID-19 threat passes, the question is now being asked whether the world's economies will be looking to the fossil fuel industry to lead the recovery.
And it will allow taxpayer dollars to be used to subsidise carbon capture and storage projects.
What I've said is that we favour technology over taxation.
The best available technologies coming out of COVID-19 to support these crucial industries, manufacturing, transport, agriculture. And we've got this $2 billion Climate Solutions Fund that is well positioned to provide that support to invest in the very...
such as clean energy and smart manufacturing.
We need a Green New Deal to build a clean economy and a caring society.
The opportunity has arrived here in this chaos that as we reform a really damaged economy, now is the time to embrace those renewables. Now is the time to make that change.
And because Australia has had such success at suppressing the pandemic, now talk is turning to the recovery. And Energy Minister Angus Taylor has talked about the economic recovery being led by the gas industry. We seem to have a national COVID-19 coordination commission that's stacked with fossil fuel executives, and Australia doesn't have the best track record on climate change in the first place. So this week I wanted to talk to our Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Australia Institute, Richie Merzian. G'day, Richie.
Hey, Ebony.
So this idea of a gas-led recovery, we'll get to that in just a second, but can you paint a picture for me? Where does Australia sit in terms of climate policy? What is Australia doing? What's our track record?
Australia has a poor track record when it comes to climate policy. A recent international survey carried out by the international think tank Germanwatch found that Australia ranked worst out of 60 major economies in terms of climate policy. And that's because Australia doesn't really have any credible climate and energy policy. It has no real way of reducing emissions in a number of key sectors. And the Minister for Energy and Emissions Reductions seems fixated on focusing on energy and only some types of energy and doing very little to actually reduce emissions. So Australia's emissions have been going up. And Australia's plan to meet its Paris Agreement target will only work if it uses a loophole in international negotiations to get away with not actually reducing over half of its undertaken target under the Paris Agreement. This real dodgy and of no real legal basis, this loophole known as the Kyoto carryover, is something that is being opposed by almost every country around the world, and it's something that Australia will struggle to justify. So when you add all this up, it paints a rather dire picture for Australia's climate policy.
Yeah, particularly after the just awful black summer of bushfires that we've had. You know, Australia has a huge amount to lose from climate change, and it's 2020 and you know, we just seem to be going backwards in terms of climate policy, which leads me to Energy Minister Angus Taylor's comments about the economic recovery being gas-led. That's obviously a huge concern. This idea of a gas-led recovery, does it have any merit, Richie?
Only for those in the gas industry. There's no particular reason why you would invest in gas as part of the economic recovery. In fact, there's many reasons why you wouldn't. Gas is quite a poor sector when it comes to job creation. According to research we have coming out soon, you could invest in almost any other sector of the economy for the same amount of money and create more jobs than you could the gas sector. So it's not good for job creation. It's not necessarily good for income for the country, given that a lot of the gas companies make huge investments and don't pay much in terms of tax. And it's certainly not good for the climate. Gas is not a transition fuel. It is a fossil fuel. It has high emissions. And really, the gas industry have gotten off far lighter than, say, the coal industry have in Australia and globally. That really comes down to just the idea that gas is less emissions intensive than coal. But when you take a much wider picture of the overall impact of gas, all the gas that's leaked from when it's extracted all the way to the leaks along the way, and then when it's ultimately consumed, gas is quite dangerous and it certainly doesn't have a role to play. So a gas-fired recovery doesn't work for really any metric that you want. And unless you were in the gas industry, you really wouldn't be pushing it.
So I noticed that the Australian Energy Market Operator put out a report recently that talked about the fact that within the electricity market, within the national electricity market, that it's entirely possible for Australia to reach 75% renewables by 2025, as long as we don't put in regulatory barriers or investment barriers or other barriers to renewables increasing their participation in the national electricity market. Can you just keep us up to date on where that's looking at the moment in terms of reforms to the NEM?
It was looking good. And then the big energy companies, the big energy companies that produce energy and then also retail it. So we're talking about Origin, talking about AGL, we're talking about Energy Australia, which is owned by a Hong Kong company. These companies, on day one of the pandemic, wrote to the energy minister, wrote to the Council of Australian Governments, and basically called on them to delay some necessary reforms to the energy market that would ease the transition for a number of technologies, that would improve how we use energy, that would reduce the need for some of the big new energy projects that are currently being pushed, that would ultimately pave the way for more renewables. So on day one, they were out there trying to delay these key reforms, ultimately because it was going to impact their business, which is using big coal and gas generators and then retailing it out to Australians. So it's not necessarily looking that good.
Yeah. And so AEMO also talked about renewables being the cheapest new form of energy to build now. So even just on economic grounds, renewables should be the way to go, right?
Oh, sure. If you just took everything just purely on a cost basis, then renewables are the best way that you can build new energy generation in terms of cost, in terms of reliability, and in terms of low emissions. But unfortunately, that doesn't work for the agenda that many have, including, I think, the energy minister, who has stated that he wants to keep gas and coal assets on the generation grid for as long as possible. And he's looking at ways to even fund, using public money, new builds of gas and coal power. And so it really shows that when it comes to the crunch, the energy minister isn't interested in a market-led approach to electricity, but is quite happy to intervene in the market to back in fossil fuels instead of letting renewables dominate, which they would have otherwise done.
Yeah, and to make electricity more expensive. That seems an odd intervention for a minister that the Prime Minister charged with making electricity prices cheaper.
Mm.
So I guess that brings me to the role of the fossil fuel industry in this big push towards making this a fossil fuel-led recovery, obviously led by the gas industry. But the government's National COVID-19 Coordination Commission is essentially stacked with fossil fuel executives.
Now, Nev Power was the former head of the Fortescue Minerals Group. He has a great experience in doing just this task. If you're working in the mining sector, you need to know how to solve problems, and big ones. There are only big issues in the mineral sector. And it's great that Neville, when I rang him the other day, I simply said, Nev, I need you to serve your country. And he quickly responded.
So there's a few people on there that don't have links to the industry. What do we know about the COVID Coordination Commission?
We don't know that much because it has been so shady to begin with. We know that the COVID commissioners were hand-picked by the Prime Minister's office. They were not picked through cabinet. We know that most of them have links to the fossil fuel industry. We know that they are being paid $2,000 a day and that the chair is getting over $250,000. And we know that they have been given a huge amount of support from every element of the government to shape Australia's future in terms of the economic recovery from the pandemic. So a major task, a lot of power, but very little scrutiny. So the CEO of this commission fronted up to an oversight committee instead of the chair, who was requested by the committee to appear. And the CEO admitted that the commission is opaque. He admitted that he didn't necessarily know what was going on, who they were talking to, what tasks they were undertaking, whether there was a conflict of interest from some of the advisors to the commission, whether there was limitations to foreign interference. So it just shows you that things are not looking good when it comes to accountability or process. And the economic recovery is ultimately in the hands of a number of corporate executives who have very little oversight.
That's hugely concerning, obviously, because they seem to have, you know, quite a bit of power and influence and almost entirely opaque, which I understand made a couple of the senators who sit on that review committee, you know, quite unhappy. But today we've had another review from another fossil fuel executive that, surprise, surprise, seems to be recommending more fossil fuels. Tell me about the Grant King review, Richie.
So there seems to be a real pattern in terms of handpicking gas executives to run these types of projects for the government instead of relying on the public servants, the hundreds of thousands of public servants that are currently on the payroll and have, you know, decades of experience in designing national interest policies. The Grant King review was even more shady. It was secretly commissioned. It did not hold public consultations. It was told to review Australia's climate policies and improve them in terms of access for the industry. And lo and behold, it was released today along with the government's agreement to almost every recommendation. And ultimately, it just cuts what is commonly referred to now as green tape. So it makes it easier to access climate funding for these big polluters. It reduces some of the oversight and regulation that's expected on these large polluters. It allows for some crediting if you overachieve on your baselines that have been set for large pollution facilities. But the real risk here is that it will import some of the dodginess that Australia is benefiting from this Kyoto Protocol into our local market. So much like Australia had a really easy baseline under the Kyoto Protocol, which is why it meet and beat its target, as the Prime Minister often says, it's now allowing companies to do the same thing locally by giving them generous baselines and now allowing them to credit in order to meet and beat their targets as well. So it's just importing dodgy accounting tricks as well. So it is not good news for the climate.
So, Richie, the media seem to be reporting one of the outcomes of that review as essentially a new emissions trading scheme. Is that what you're talking about there? Can you unpack that for me?
So the King Review recommended that we take this safeguards mechanism, the whole purpose of which was to cap the emissions on the largest polluting facilities in the country, and to allow those facilities to get credit for overachieving their current caps. And in a sense, it creates a market mechanism. But that market mechanism is quite a dodgy one. It's basically the same principle that they got Australia into trouble with the Kyoto Protocol. It's a very generous baseline and allowing crediting to carry forward, which ultimately reduces the overall emissions ambition. Now the King Review is talking about importing that same principle to the local market. So it's not necessarily good for the climate, but also it's probably not even going to fly for the coalition, which seems to be allergic to anything in the form of a carbon market, let alone one as soft as this. So it is something to keep an eye on to see where it goes, but ultimately it doesn't look good.
And one last thing I'll ask you about in terms of that review. Am I mistaken in thinking that it also talked about that beautiful old unicorn of carbon capture and storage, which always seems to be 10 years away?
It certainly does. So what the King Review recommended is that we come up with a new way to fund carbon capture and storage, given that we have already spent, as a government, $1.3 billion on CCS, and we don't have a single clean coal program to show for it. And now King is talking about a new method to fund CCS. And not only that, but he wants to water down the limitations on the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, our two key bodies to fund clean energy. He wants to allow them to fund carbon capture and storage. So it's not enough that they've pork-barreled $1.3 billion with nothing to show for it. They want to tap into the limited amount of climate funding, the $2 billion we have over the next 15 years, and use that as well. Talk about greedy.
That's quite something. I remember, I can't remember if it was 07 or 08, I went to check out one of the state-of-the-art, I think it was called Zero Gen carbon capture and storage projects in Queensland. And we drove past it and it was a paddock. And yep. I think it probably still is. So yep. That's the state of carbon capture and storage in Australia.
There we go. Not much has changed. And it's worth adding that not only has Australia gotten carbon capture and storage wrong, so has almost every country around the world. The International Energy Agency, even the IPCC, every standard, every goal set for carbon capture and storage has failed, and yet we continue to back this loser.
Well, that's a rather depressing picture. What are other countries doing at the moment, Richie?
Many other countries are doing many other things. If you take a view beyond just the immediate next few months, you realize that climate change is the crisis that we will need to turn our attention to again. It was only, a few months ago, as you mentioned, the Black Summer was here. Many of those communities on the South Coast, are still dealing with the consequences. And so climate change requires attention. And if you're going to be spending hundreds of billions of dollars as part of an economic recovery, then the least you can do is make sure that that aligns with your climate obligations. So many countries, many industrialized countries, like New Zealand, like South Korea, like many European nations, are looking at how they combine the two. They're looking at how you can tick both boxes. You can stimulate the economy from the pandemic, but you can also drive climate action. You invest in clean energy. You invest in manufacturing based on clean energy. You invest in hydrogen energy, but using renewable energy rather than using gas and coal. You invest in transport that is low emissions, like electric vehicles. So many different ways that you can go about doing this to build jobs and economic sectors that last beyond just the near term. And that's the real opportunity. And it's an opportunity lost. And you'd think Australia would do it. We have a minister for emissions reductions and energy. It's within Angus Taylor's portfolio to address both, but he doesn't seem to do that. And the question should be asked why, because this is a rare opportunity to do it. And we're squandering it once again.
So in summary, now is the perfect time to be investing in renewables to make electricity cheaper in the long run, but also cleaner. We could be investing in the electric vehicles market and making sure we're prepared for that. And essentially all we're doing is investing in or trying to invest in more fossil fuels. Is that about the summary?
That's about the summary. There's not much good news when it comes to climate change, but the silver lining is that there has been a dip in emissions in the transport sector, and the electricity sector has dropped a slight amount too. So there's been a slight pause on national emissions, but that's an opportunity to actually build back better. And hopefully that message will come through to Angus Taylor. And to the Prime Minister, they just need to stop commissioning fossil fuel executives to provide them with that advice.
And just finally, Richie, I wondered if we might just have a word on the states here, because we've all seen very clearly that the government is able to take expert medical advice during this pandemic and has had great success. But there's also been a rather large degree of consensus between the Commonwealth government and the states. Do you have any hope that this role for expertise and the role of science and the new consensus that we've found during the pandemic will continue when it comes to climate change? Is there any hope from even the states leading the charge on this?
You definitely take some hope from the states. You know, every state and territory has a net zero by 2050 target, which is the least a developed country can do to help meet the Paris Agreement goals. And this includes the coalition governments in South Australia, in New South Wales, in Tasmania. And we've seen some ambitious things put forward by South Australia, which could hit 100% renewable energy in the next few years. We've seen Tasmania talk about making 200% renewable energy. We've seen New South Wales look at investing in new renewable energy zones, and also undertaking a review of how it can combine economic stimulus with low emission pathways. So there's some good signs from the states, and hopefully that collaboration, that cooperation, that national approach on both federal and state percolates through and delivers us an actual economic recovery that also aligns with climate action.
Thank you, Richie.
Pleasure.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so please stay tuned and make sure you're subscribed on your favourite podcast app. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 19th of May, 2020, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit tai.org.au for all our latest climate and energy research, and also to check out our upcoming webinars for our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series, the next of which will feature Zali Stegel, the independent member for Warringah, talking about the role of climate action in the economic recovery for Australia. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian, all one word. And this episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with the help of Ethan Ricks and Lucy Law. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. And please stay home if you can, keep washing those hands, and thanks for listening.